take your protein pills. The Poisoned Electric Head Story.
Chapter 25, Heroes, continued. Captain Sensible. We supported Captain Sensible just the once, but it was a big thrill, as we'd all been big fans of the classic Damned in our teens. So much so, that in our eyes, even his foray into novelty hits and game show themes couldn't tarnish his exalted evergreen status as punk's court jester par excellence. Fond memories of chasing him and Dave Vanian around parked cars in front of Liverpool Royal Court for autographs resonated in my mind as we sat together post-soundcheck. And all those years later, the urge to get his signature still overpowered any pretensions in me of rockstar cool reserve. He happily obliged, of course. Chatting to him in the bar after the show, I asked him if it didn't annoy him, people asking for autographs. He replied that his day-to-day normally consisted of deflecting dirty looks from the other parents as he picked the kids up outside Croydon Primary. So no, quite the reverse. A true gent. David Allen. This concert came about under unusual circumstances and probably did little to enhance our tenuous standing with the space agency. But by that time, their gigs for us had all but dried up and we were doing fine under our own steam. Maybe we'd made it clear that £50 support slots were counterproductive to us locally. But more than likely, our asshole behaviour had precluded us from any further involvement. However, for some reason, we kept emerging in their universe like an unwanted bubble under the wallpaper. Thus, when David Allen came to town, an astute move on the part of the Citadel's promoter, the first we heard of it was when we glanced at that month's listing in the local free paper. And there it was, David Allen's Magic Brothers, Friday, June the 12th. We quickly realised that we were playing that night anyway. We'd decided to move things up a notch from our usual Peasley Cross shows and try our hand in the flagship Labour Club of the town, the cavernous Tatto Heath, which welcomed us with open arms despite being a fiercely traditional place and to the horror of the regulars. Word had spread through clubland about this particular cash cow, and like the lady says, money talks and bullshit walks. The only dilemma lay in the hands of local heads, who had to choose which soundtrack would accompany their Friday night skinning up duties. Then, in what was a bold move, Jake from the Citadel rang asking us if we could reschedule, and when we refused, announced that he would inform the space agency that he was pulling the gig. We felt bad for David Allen, but at the same time it was hard not to feel the tiniest twinge of gloating validation. After all, our attempts to join the Gong family had left us feeling not so much like a long-lost brother, more like a bog-eyed inbred banjo-playing cousin. A few days later, the situation took another strange twist and resulted in David Allen, after much consultation, agreeing to join us at Tatto Heath on the bill there, much to the chagrin of the support band. They were a power rock trio called Israfel, all excellent musicians playing much in the style of Rush, and had been badgering us for a support slot for some time. We were eternally criticised over the support band issue, and for us it was a no-win situation. Any competent bands we chose resented the audience not acknowledging the fact, and if we used an inexperienced band, always at their behest I might add, we were accused of picking them just to make ourselves look better. We were bombarded daily with requests from Deadfly customers, who, seeing only the local exposure it offered, failed to realise that a sizeable chunk of the crowd weren't even that taken with our music, so unless they played the Zappa Floyd card, they were lambs to the slaughter. After a while, we sidestepped the dilemma via more practical means. We chose trios. They took up less room. These changes in events meant that Israfel would have to go on earlier, leaving just the thorny subject of who would follow. In terms of experience, fame, reputation, well, in most terms, really, the Magic Brothers pissed all over us. But David Allen's music had a gentle, pastoral, spiritually uplifting quality and was mainly acoustic in delivery. So these facts, coupled with the full-throttle psych fest we indulged in, meant that they got to go on second. I truly believe it wouldn't have worked any other way. And even though they were fine and dandy about it, looking back, it still seems audacious of us. On the night itself, a record crowd turned out and witnessed something very special indeed. They were warmed up by Israfel during the post-arrival pint-quaffing session, before being mesmerised and hypnotised, as David Allen's snake charmer qualities transported them through ambrosial vistas of moon-kissed mystical delight. At times you could almost hear a blim drop, a piece of cannabis resin deemed so small as to be of almost no consequence, as Graham Clark's dreamy violin floated through the 600-strong crowd, intertwining with Mark Robson's haunting flute. And though they may have been a trio who didn't take up much room, they sure knew how to captivate one. Despite a long history of quality turns stretching back to the 50s, I'm sure Tato Heath had never played host to such artistry, and we couldn't help but feel blessed for having inadvertently and quite accidentally made it occur. And here it is, the actual recording from that night 25 years ago in Tato Heath Labour Club. David Allen is sadly no longer with us, but it's reproduced here with the blessing of Graham Clark and Mark Robson. This is David Allen's Magic Brothers with Children of the New World.
Okay, there's something for the kids here and for the mothers. I know there's a few mothers here. Okay. Thank you.
Chapter 26, Sunscape at Cindy's. One day, Bun and I went to the post office to see if there was anything of interest in our P.O. box, as was our regular Monday afternoon ritual. In those pre-email days, it was our chosen method of band communication, and one could never be sure what strange letters people might see fit to send us. For example, one time there was a letter from Jello Biafra, the singer of the Dead Kennedys, who had somehow stumbled across our first album and decided to tell us what he thought of it. Maybe the H.R. Geiger sleeve had caught his eye. The Dead Kennedys included a Geiger poster with their album Frankenchrist, a piece entitled Penis Landscape, which Biafra felt encapsulated American materialistic greed. Its inclusion resulted in a swathe of obscenity charges aimed at his Alternative Tentacles label, another attempt by the conservative right to destroy him in the name of respectability. We displayed the letter on the office notice board with ill-concealed pride, to the amazement and disbelief of the unholy row and punk metal tyke's deterrent, who thought it was a fake, despite the Alternative Tentacles bat stamp. On this particular day, there was a curious letter from Italy, from a bunch of guys in Milan calling themselves Sunscape. They were part of an Italian progressive scene which looked to artists like Steve Hillage and Osric Tentacles for inspiration, and they too had picked up on our first album. As the letter revealed itself, it transpired that three of them planned to visit England on a kind of prog rock pilgrimage and intended coming to St. Helens to track us down in order to
get stoned and jam the beautiful space rock music together.
Our initial reaction was that if they expected to find us in a permanent cannabis haze, performing blissed out freeform improvisations for days on end, then they were going to be sorely disappointed. And for one sobering moment, it dawned on us just how far removed the dull reality was from the image we evidently projected. Tempting as it was to file the letter away and forget about it, we couldn't dismiss the fact that in Italy at least we had some interest. And then when Bun's daughter Kerry got wind of the proposal, it was settled. Three Italian boys were coming to stay. Yippee. Kerry's observations on things were a considerable source of amusement. When the Deadfly studio relocated to Bun's kitchen and we commenced to do all our recording there, Kerry was suitably unimpressed. She was at the age when her prime occupation was rolling her eyes at her embarrassing parents. But comments like,
"Ugh, don't go in there, Bun's recording an album with his weird mates,"
failed to have the desired effect on her friends, who thought that a recording studio in your kitchen sat somewhere between worth a look and no way, oh my god, well cool. Filippo, Marco and Matteo arrived a few weeks later, spending their first night in St. Helens in a tent in Bun's garden, after which they set up camp in my house. No tears were shed by Kerry at their departure. Her idealistic teen preconceptions were cruelly shot down by the appearance of three hippie types, who bore no resemblance to Karate Kid era Ralph Macchio. Filippo was the leader. He was the oldest and spoke the best English. He wasn't in the band as such. He was more of a manager, minder to the other two, who played guitar and bass and were fervent music obsessives. That first day, they dropped their rucksacks down and spent the whole afternoon rifling through my record collection, playing tracks back to back. I was occupying the ground floor of a huge Victorian house at the time, so not only did I have room for visitors, but it was also the band's storeroom. So when they grew bored with vinyl, they wandered in the back to grab some musical gear. It's a good job they were so easily pleased, as I was somewhat at a loss what to do with them. But fortunately, Filippo wasn't short of ideas. His creative medium was film. He was documenting the whole trip with a camcorder and intended to edit it into an arthouse movie on their return. He assured me it had a plot, yet it seemed to be sufficiently elastic to incorporate any ideas that came along, which is how I came to be striding up our street in full Lecchied regalia, followed by two dancing Italians. You see, aliens had stolen their only means of getting home, the gear stick from their little Fiat, and they'd spotted it displayed in my front window. Continental audiences are more open to non-linear narrative, I know, but I thought this was pushing the envelope a tad. Still, it gave the neighbours another reason to rue the day I moved in, if nothing else. On Tuesday evening, I decided to take them to a local nightclub, a heinous place that was trying to boost its midweek trade with Tempe a pint night, a scheme we'd cottoned onto a few weeks previously. It was a good boots-filling night out once you realised that the beer was cheap, but the glasses were priceless. If you didn't have one to hand, then it was a long wait until one turned up. Eager to avoid this, we began stockpiling them under our table, taking turns to go to the bar and order 10 pints at a time, much to the chagrin of the thirsty underage scallies surrounding us. Despite the gall we displayed, they knew better than to mess with a gang of weird older guys on a drinking frenzy. The Italians loved Cindy's and swore to write a song about the place the moment they returned to Italy. Even the name evoked mystery and suspense to them, bless them. To everyone else in the town, it equated shithole. During their stay, I'm sure they must have sat in on one of our practices. But if not, they had a good time nonetheless. We did nothing out of the ordinary, just the usual hospitality you extend to people who've travelled a long way. But to Filippo and the others, it hit deep. As they left, they threw out an invitation to visit them. If ever we found ourselves in Milan, then the debt would be repaid tenfold. And waving as their car pulled away, I remember thinking, us lot in Milan, fat chance.
Chapter 27, One Foot in the Rave.
The Sex Pistols at the Screen on the Green, the Clash at the 100 Club, the Stones in the Park, all events that every man and his dog claims to have been present at, despite the sheer logistic impossibility of such claims. Well, you can add Castle Morton to the list, which, unlike most of the above, is less easy to refute, as 25,000 people showed up, not to mention a shitload of dogs. It started out just like any other event on 1992's Free Festival calendar. But being the first of the season, maybe more people made the effort to attend. As ever, its location remained a guarded secret until the last minute, but we knew it to be happening somewhere in the Malvern Hills. A series of phone calls along the way, guiding us to the actual site. I recall we were in two minds about going, but it was far too early for crusty fatigue to have set in, and as we had a gig in London that weekend, we saw no harm in dropping in a few days earlier for an impromptu warm-up appearance. Sightings of buses and other vehicles in the area told us we were on the right track, and before long we found ourselves in a long tailback, which trundled infinitesimally onto the site. These things were always occurring, and were usually down to someone breaking down further along the path, thus blocking everyone else's passage. In such cases, AF or Billy would wander ahead to investigate the hold-up, where they would inevitably find some clapped-out shed on wheels, held together by willpower alone, whose owner thought that MOT stood for marijuana on tick, and that the AA was only for wimps who couldn't take their special brew. Still, there was never any shortage of amateur grease monkeys on hand to cast an eye over the antiquated pistons and rusty plugs, or indeed pickup trucks to haul it out of the way. On this occasion, however, the delay seemed to be purely down to everybody deciding to show up at the same hour. So by the time we'd got on and chosen a place to park, it was already night, so we no doubt drank ourselves into a stupor and crashed out, leaving any exploration until the next morning. Billy was first one up, being high on life and Armenian philosophy, and after a brief walkabout, he returned with the news that there seemed to be a lot of people. But only as more of us investigated did the true enormity of the situation sink in. It was vast. Trucks and vans were crammed together in all directions, and extended as far as the eye could see. There seemed to be no end to it. We had managed to locate the Wango stage the night before, parking adjacent to it, and discussion with Marge and Scouse revealed that the gathering had exceeded everyone's expectations and was still growing. One reason for this was the culmination of a trend that most Fezzigoers had noticed over the years, namely the growing presence of ravers, or cheesy quavers, as they were less than affectionately known. Starting out as an indoor phenomenon with warehouse parties in disused buildings, the movement had felt the restrictive sting of the authorities brought on by the glare of sensationalist publicity, and had been forced ever further out of the cities and into the countryside. Once out there, ravers were bound to collide with the pre-existing and established New Age traveller circuit, resulting in a joining of forces, though not without some animosity. Some travellers felt their way of life had been hijacked, and that the presence of ravers would throw a spotlight on a scene that had been allowed to flourish relatively ignored. And the ravers? Well, they didn't care much either way, as long as the bass drum eventually kicked in. Basically, everyone wanted the same thing. The freedom to party and the chance to escape, really escape, into the wide open space.
away from bouncers and door policies and four fucking walls. The hippies had always known that the countryside was where it's at, and the loved-up ravers were beginning to realise that if you wanted to give your entire generation a group hug, you needed somewhere big enough to do it. So Castle Morton became the Woodstock of the 90s. Forget that money-grabbing MTV-sponsored joke that had the gall to use the same name. With Wango Riley's providing live music for the old guard, Spiral Tribe creating a huge non-stop rave arena, and any thoughts of us continuing on to London rapidly melting away. Not that we could have left had we wanted to. We were gridlocked in. Now, the first thing you do at festivals is locate the stage. And as we'd already done that, me and Bill set about locating the next most important thing, the Scrumpy Man, as these things nearly always took place down south, it being blessed with so much open countryside. The beautiful South band name sarcastically refers to this phenomenon of beauty being in the eye of a beholder whose entire field of vision hasn't been blighted by tarmac and concrete. Then the chances of a scrumpy vendor being on site were high, though with 10,000 vehicles to choose from, our chances of locating him were somewhat smaller. Nevertheless, despite the crushing odds, we tracked him down in a far-flung field and bought a gallon each. For without wishing to labour the point as raised in an earlier chapter, we possessed neither the stimulation threshold nor the resilient hides of cows, and had to get smashed in order to spend any significant length of time hanging around in a field. It was a pleasantly sunny day and we wandered around relatively unhassled, for though we wouldn't have begrudged a passing opportunist a swig from our plentiful supplies, few approached us. Evidently Scrumpy was a beverage that even wild-eyed berserkers eyed with caution and fear. Fezzigoers were fiercely loyal when it came to their 9% loony juice, and would swear by the merits of Special Brew over Tennant's Super and vice versa. Homemade Special Brew t-shirts were a common sight, extolling the wearer's affection for the brand, appreciation and gratitude lovingly painted into every fibre of the fabric, and true appreciation could only be shown by wearing it non-stop until it went from pristine white to grimy battleship grey. I doubt they came with washing guidelines. It would be like kamikaze planes coming with landing instructions. Such were the pleasant effects of the Scrumpy that Bill and I found ourselves sozzled and sunstroked, making a return visit for a second batch, though at this point fatigue was creeping in just as daylight was lazily and stealthily creeping out. When we returned to the van, gallons in hand and a vacant stir in our eyes, we were greeted by Bun, who, relieved to see us, informed us that we were due on stage within the hour. His relief at our return rapidly being replaced by despair at our shabby, glazed-eyed, pitiful demeanour. I must admit that of the two of us, I was easily in the worst shape. Bill's size and drinking prowess meant that even the strongest of ales was akin to a bucket of water being thrown on a forest fire, and he was still very much in the game. Faced with this inconvenient turn of events, I feebly proposed that a snooze might see me right, and more or less sparked out there and then, over a couple of conveniently placed speaker cabinets. In my drunken half-sleep, I could hear the concerns being voiced about me being able to perform, this being in all likelihood our only chance at what bore all the hallmarks of being a landmark event. Though I don't recall loads of bands being present, it was just the usual die-hard perennials who frequented these gatherings. Back to the Planet, The Stormed, Radical Dance Faction. Certainly, it wasn't graced by any superstar crusties like the Levellers, who we never once rubbed shoulders with at a free festival. Maybe we missed them. I clung on to the brief oasis of unconsciousness for as long as I could, but the call inevitably came. Ironic considering past gatherings where we'd waited days sometimes for a crack at the stage, and the hour that followed was as tortuous and painful as any I can remember. Some sort of mist-shrouded autopilot took over, and things just seemed to happen of their own volition. It was like that simple but effective technique of running the film backwards, causing broken crockery to leap off the floor and reconstitute itself on the table. Before I knew it, there was a rack of synths in front of me, and I was squeezing that damn helmet on, feeling its sharp edges dig into my skull more keenly than usual. The customary disorganised preamble took place, a frenzy of shouts and exchanged glances. Then four clicks put an end to any further discussion, as switches violently clicked from red to green somewhere deep in my brain. I won't say our performance was legendary, but it was manic and brutal enough, and we left our mark on the occasion in admirable style. as did Spiral Tribe with their impressive rave area, flanked by cybernetic totem poles, which, to my memory, didn't stop pumping out music for the whole 4 days. There was some talk of a failed attempt to blow a police helicopter out of the sky with a distress flare, but general consensus said it was just a luckily aimed firework. Still, it all added to the mythology of the event, and the media monster it rapidly became. This is what the Daily Mirror had to say about it, under the headline,
"Hippie days are here again."
The hippie days of the 60s were back with a vengeance yesterday, as Britain's biggest ever illegal party swung into its fourth night. But for the tiny village reluctantly playing host to 25,000 revellers, it seemed that the self-styled peace people were making war, not love. A police helicopter flying over the crowd narrowly escaped disaster when it was fired on with five marine distress flares, and the ear-splitting throb of acid music could be heard 10 miles from the sprawling city of tents and campervans infesting Castlemorden Common near Malvern, Worcester. Meanwhile, police could only stand and watch for fear of sparking a full-scale riot. Drug dealers openly set up shop to push ecstasy and LSD. One even did the rounds, bearing a tray of freshly baked hash cookies. Used tringes were amongst rubbish littering the 700-acre common. Furious locals report their garden fences have been ripped up for firewood. Chickens and sheep have been poached. Some families have sent terrified children to stay with relatives. But others have become prisoners in their own homes, surrounded by the vehicles choking the narrow lanes. A villager, 29, said, "Before long, the residents are going to get their shotguns and blast that music machine." West Mercia police had 400 officers, some in riot gear, on standby. They claim the helicopter attack vindicates their decision to keep a low profile.
The image of a mob of angry villagers descending on the beast, armed with burning torches and pitchforks, is particularly melodramatic, but does illustrate the mass hysteria Castlemorden generated in the nation's collective psyche. And it was enough to send a shudder through the establishment, the likes of which hadn't been seen since the Pistols hijacked the Queen's Jubilee. Monocles dropped, voices were raised in the House, and the law was promptly amended, spawning the lamentable and insidious Public Order Act. Despite its draconian erosion of everybody's rights, we took some solace in the fact that it was possible to put the wind up the government simply by wearing some scurry masks, the wusses. So, Mick Jagger's butterfly on a wheel, Johnny Rotten's attack on the monarchy, and 25,000 crusty ravers scurrying the shit out of Whitehall. It's comforting and gratifying to know that Poisoned Electric Head played a part in that esteemed lineage. And here in the new millennium, it's high time someone reminded the corridors of power again just who works for whom. Well, what are you waiting for, kids?
Chapter 28, Jeff Davis Eyes. I first started going to Probe in Liverpool when I was a teenager, and it was the coolest record shop in the world. So cool that you got butterflies just walking in there. The guy behind the counter had empty black sockets where his eyes should have been. Contact lenses, of course, but in 1978, and the place had a unique smell, a sort of musty patchouli essence hung in the air, and there was always a parade of weird types toing and froing up and down the stairs behind the counter. Even the carrier bags were cool. It was worth buying a record just for the unconscious swagger you adopted by being seen with one. It still exists today, but its location has changed. It's no longer on the corner of Button Street and Matthew Street. All that area has become a Beatles tourist mecca. Back then it was the epicentre of hip alternative culture, with the Armadillo Tea Rooms where Echo and the Bunnymen hung out, Hesse's where the Fab Four bought their gear, and Extreme's clothes shop and hairdressers where one of a flock of seagulls worked. It wasn't uncommon to see Julian Cope walking down the street in the boots and flying jacket he'd worn on Top of the Pops a week earlier. The flock of seagulls phenomenon baffles me, but pleasantly so. Little more than a blip on the radar of 80s music, they've become a byword for the era, constantly referred to in sitcoms like Friends and name-dropped in hip movies like Pulp Fiction. Unbeknownst to me at the time, Probe also had a record label of the same name.
though I not long after discovered that the eyeless guy was the singer in a band called Dead or Alive. So it was fitting that 13 years later, Poisoned Electric Head would release their first album on Probe Records. The man behind the operation was Jeff Davis, and we'd played enough times in Liverpool to have caught his attention. How the initial introductions came about escapes me, though I do remember us all trooping round to his house for tea and cakes to talk business. We struck a deal that cited us to take care of recording and artwork origination, Jeff to arrange production and distribution, and all profits to be split 50-50. It was done on a handshake, a gentleman's agreement, for he was indeed a gentleman, one of a dying breed of indie label mavericks, who had seen their heyday in the 80s, tossing out quirky thrown-together 45s via the Rough Trade distribution network. Our subsequent involvement together meant we got to visit him regularly in his office above Probe Records. Pete Burns had of course moved on to spinning right round like a record baby, but it was still a hell of a kick to stroll in, nod to the assistant and climb the back stairs, negotiating boxes of vinyl at every turn. No matter what time of day you dropped in, you would always find Jeff in the same position, sat at his desk with the phone in his right hand and his left inextricably clamped to his forehead, to the point that I often fantasised about turning up with a freshly boiled kettle in order to remove it and give him the use of both arms again. The place was always in chaos. Boxes of vinyl, large and small, were piled up in every corner, and his desk was a riot of papers and invoices. The indie glory days were on the decline, and he was feeling the pinch of major label dominance, squeezing out the last vestiges of idiosyncrasy. But like a willfully stubborn landowner in the imminent railroad's path, he refused to be bought out or relocated. He bore none of the trappings of a rich businessman, probably because he wasn't, because he was in it for the love of the music, and that's an area of intangible wealth the financial experts have yet to devise a system to chart. The album artwork was painted by Phil as ever, and the back cover featured a photo of the band in big pointy head outfits superimposed over it. We hired a local boy to take the shot, a jobbing photographer whose normal bread and butter was weddings and portraits, and he was chosen purely for the proximity of his showroom to the Dead Fly. He didn't refuse the work, fortunately, as I imagine Anton Corbijn was busy that day, and actually turned up, which is more than Bill and AF did. So to achieve the shoot, we put Telebot in Bill's place, and as Bun's girlfriend and a mate happened to be around, we stuck a mask on one of them to stand in for AF. I still can't fathom to this day why they thought it not important enough to turn up, but back then we half expected it and casually shrugged it off. The merging of the group photo with the artwork was achieved with scissors and glue, the final touch being the text, which I painstakingly applied with letter-set transfer. There was no room for error, so it involved more squinting and second-guessing than is good for the nervous system. But looking at it, I didn't do a bad job. The finished piece measured exactly the dimensions of an album sleeve down to the last millimetre, which we thought was what was required. But of course it had to be reduced for the CD format, so it could have been the size of the wall. It was a mistake we wouldn't repeat, the artwork for the second album being 6 feet across. Despite Probe's low-key approach, the album managed to creep into the indie charts at number 19, two spots down from Nirvana. Its minor success owing much to Jeff's extensive Goodwill distribution network, with copies finding themselves as far as mainland Europe and the US. But in terms of making us a household name, it left us still with a huge mountain to climb.
Take your protein pills. To be continued.
Poisoned electric head. Poisoned electric head. Poisoned electric head. Poisoned electric head. Poisoned electric head.